Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. What a fabulous day it is today. I just love these Seattle sky days. Well, we've got three great guests coming up for you today. Three very different guests living their own, following their own path. And first of all, we are joined by Lucia Renee, and we're going to take a peek into the mystical anticipation around the year 2012 with Lucia and her new book called Unplugging the Patriarchy. Coming up around 12:20, Lisa Shannon will share how a visit to her therapist's office and a show on Oprah drove her to leave her successful business as an art director and producer in Portland, Oregon, and took her to what she describes as the worst place in the world to be a woman. She is doing amazing work now with other women, and we'll talk about that later. And we'll end today's show with one of my favorite writers. There are novelists and there are storytellers, and Diane Hammond is really a fine storyteller. She paints vivid pictures and characters in Seeing Stars. And she's had two previous critically acclaimed novels. This is her third critically acclaimed novel. And I'm pleased to have her back around 12:40 today. But first, it might be easier to tell you what Lucia Renee has not done. She really has an incredible background. She's spent time as a professional actress, a computer science consultant, and teacher of self-discovery. She has nearly 40 years' experience in the exploration of consciousness and has been ordained as a Buddhist monk after serving a 17-year apprenticeship to an enlightened master. Her new book, Unplugging the Patriarchy, examines the experiences of three women trained in the mystical arts as they unite to take apart the 5,000-year-old patriarchy and usher in a new age of balance and expanded consciousness. Lucia Renee, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with you, Vicki.
So this is a very interesting book. You describe it as fictionalized memoir. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, the work is based on my own experience and the experiences of the three women that you mentioned, all of whom are trained in psychic perception and mysticism, and all of whom had done a great deal of research about what was going on in the world. So we included both left brain and right brain approach to the problem of what is this 5,000-year-old patriarchy and how does it limit consciousness. So I leave it up to the reader, really, to decide what is fictionalized and what is not, because some people are not mystics, and that's a stretch for them, and then they read it and they like the research and they find it just a good page-turning detective story.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these two women really involved in your life?
Oh, absolutely.
And did they help with writing the book, or did you do this all alone?
No, I wrote the book alone. There was one woman that I used to consult, because it is a book about the various energies of the patriarchal system in which we live, the components. It's sort of, if you will, it pops the hood on the patriarchy and shows the engine and the way it works. And I was very, very concerned to make the energy of the book and the journey in consciousness that the reader takes while reading the book as clean and as pristine as possible. So the woman in the book, who is a really world-class psychic, she read the book and reviewed it with me many, many times, so that we literally went through and combed it again and again so that it is very clean.
Yeah. The book begins with an appointment. You say you have an appointment. It's June 2002, and you just knew you had to be in New Mexico on the solstice, but you didn't know why.
Right. I had asked to be of service many times throughout my spiritual training. And at this particular time, the rug had really been pulled out from under me. I had lost, at that point, all of my family. I had just been fired from my job. It's one of those times when you hit rock bottom and you really have no place to turn. So when you ask at that point, please guide me, please tell me what I'm supposed to be doing with my life now, you ask deeply and you really listen for the answer. And I was given an answer, and basically I was told, you know, you've been prepared for many lifetimes to do this particular piece of energetic work and what we want you to do. And the voices speaking to me were my spiritual lineage that my teacher had introduced me to, so a lineage of warriors and a lineage of enlightenment. And they said, spend the next 6 months just studying the way the world works. Read everything you can get your hands on. And once you understand it intellectually, your job will be to identify the underlying mystical structure. In other words, on a subtle level, what does the whole thing rest on? How does it look? How was it constructed? And then to take it apart. And so the adventure begins of me trying to wrap my arms around what is really going on in the world, and beginning from, you know, point A, which I knew nothing about the New World Order. I knew nothing about the way things really worked.
Let's talk a little bit about 2012, because I've heard various descriptions of this. I have a friend who claims that in 2012 the great masters are going to come down to the earth. You're looking at this more from a matriarch society. The book is called Unplugging the Patriarch. Tell us a little bit about what you see is going to be happening.
Well, not so much matriarch. I think we had a matriarchal era some 6,000 years ago, and now for the last 5,000 years, we've lived in an era, you know, patriarchy simply means a male-dominated society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're moving into an era which is based on the energies of the heart. And that means balance and equality of the sexes. So we're rebalancing the masculine-feminine energies on the planet. And that's a pretty big deal because they've been out of balance for a long time. And so this era of male domination is coming to an end, as is the entire cycle of time. We had an old cycle and the Atlantean cycle, now this cycle. It's hundreds of thousands of years, and the energies are winding down. And actually, the energies of the new world or the new paradigm in consciousness that technically is to begin in 2012, at least that's what most people think, and I agree, it's already present. And so one really has the opportunity at this point to unplug their energies from this old world that is falling apart and to take up residence in this new consciousness of heart-based energies.
Mm. You write on a blog that you you write for on your website, and you say that you read recently somewhere, Earth is not sick, she is pregnant. And you say that makes sense to you. Tell us a little bit about that, Lucia, if you would.
Yes, I've had a close relationship with Mother Earth. I've done a lot of meditating on her, and I don't think, from her perspective, she feels very sick. I mean, I think from her perspective, she probably has a skin rash and is a little bit out of alignment, needs a few chiropractic adjustments. And to us, that's a very big deal. When Earth moves, you know, that's violent, and we have an extreme reaction to it. But from her vantage point, she's really going through, at the moment, and I think this year it will intensify, contractions. She's giving birth to this new paradigm in consciousness. And she's being aided by the divine feminine energy that is sweeping the planet, literally in a tidal wave. And so this divine feminine energy, which is coming in really to balance the masculine and feminine, the core issue that is out of balance in our society. If you live in a male-dominated society, obviously you need an onslaught of feminine energy to balance that out.
Right.
So Earth is being facilitated in this transition in consciousness that she's giving birth to. And so what we're experiencing as humans who live on her is that we will go through a contraction, and all of our shadow, all of our issues, everything that triggers us will come up in our face. And usually they're about a week long, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer. And then there'll be a release, and we'll go, oh, thank God, you know, that I... That was very, very difficult. But the good news is that we have changed, that we are suddenly, we've dropped baggage. We're in a more ascended state of consciousness. So this is going to continue to go on, I think, until 2012, when actually the new paradigm in consciousness takes root.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the book. I'm going to assume that the teacher you talk about in there is maybe a real person. is based very heavily on your teacher. Is that true, or you don't want to disclose that?
Oh, no, absolutely. I do disclose it on my website, and I'm happy for people to tap into his teachings. His teachings are woven throughout the book, and they're very beautiful, very diverse spiritual teachings. So his name was Rama, and if you go to my website, which is unplugfromthepatriarchy.com, you'll see a link where you can get to a lot of his MP3 recordings that are free.
Mm. Now, in another blog that you wrote, you say that your teacher used to tell his students, you don't really know who you are. You think of yourself as the personal ego. The closest you ever come to feeling who you are is after you've taken a spiritual fall and decide to get up again. At that moment, you get up. That's who you are. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that to me. I found that kind of intriguing.
Mm. Yes, well, we are conditioned from birth to think of ourselves as the personal self. But as anyone who has studied consciousness and investigated a little bit knows, we all contain the divine within. I call that the universal self. I don't particularly like the word higher self, because then that says to me I need to go out of my body someplace else that's better. And the universal self I use because this says I'm going to drop back into the depth of my own consciousness and find out who I am through direct experience. So we are both, but we are heavily, heavily conditioned, especially at this in this patriarchal era, to experience ourselves as the personal self. And this is, we live in a world of duality, so polar opposites, male and female, and good and bad, and right and wrong, and dark and light. And really, the universal self has nothing to do with all of those things. Or you could say it embraces, it incorporates all of those things. And so what happens for a person on a spiritual path who is perhaps meditating or reading and studying and prayer and looking deeply within themselves is that the universal self, in a very gradual way, begins to dominate the awareness field, the personal self, the personal ego, falls away little by little, and the universal self begins to dominate. And that's the part where it gets really interesting. That's the part where we experience a sense of balance or equilibrium, where we become at peace. And so this is the journey, my personal journey, that I describe in the book by unplugging my energies, by examining my buy-ins to the patriarchal system in which we live. I manage to pull back each of those, I manage to deconstruct each of those personal aspects of the ego, and then more and more the universal self begins to dominate.
One of the things you talk about in the book, you have a chapter called One World Government. You're not a fan of the media at large or politicians or corporations. You talk a lot about propaganda that we've brought into. When you were writing this, did it help clarify things in your mind for you about your beliefs?
In all of those things, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, the book describes my journey of reconciling or bringing to rest all of those polarities. So we have the media, and the true value of the media, I think, is to disseminate information in order to raise consciousness. At least that's the way it should be used.
Yeah, yeah.
And instead, it's being used to broadcast propaganda, whatever, you know, the patriarchal elite or the ruling elite want us to hear, want us to believe in. And that limits consciousness. So the two things are antithetical. They are at opposite extremes. And so what I found personally was by examining, you know, I was very much triggered by the fact that the media did that. I found that abusive. I found it horrific when I read about it. But what I also found was that I had to be willing to look inside of myself and say, well, how do I still do that? How do I manipulate people when I talk to them if I want something from them? How do I broadcast propaganda in my life? And by being willing to bring it back on that personal level and be perfectly honest with myself about my conditioning, then I would be able to see both sides of the coin and in the end bring that to rest And so with each of the components of the patriarchy that you mentioned, I did that. And I can safely say at this point that there's nothing about that patriarchal system that triggers me anymore. I more or less, in terms of consciousness, found a way to stand at the eye of the storm. So if the patriarchy is coming apart and we are still bought into it with our energies, we're going to be very much affected by that. Mm. But if we have withdrawn our energies from it and reclaimed those and balanced those aspects out within our own consciousness, then we come to peace.
We're almost at the end of the segment, Lucia. I want to ask you very quickly what I suspect everybody who reads this is going to take away something different. What is your hope that they glean from your fictionalized memoir?
Mm. Well, I think we're living in a very extraordinary time. And it's supposed to be a challenging time. We're at the end of a cycle. How could it not feel challenging? But the good news about that is it allows us to change. And so I have written a book as a mystic. And someone doesn't have to be a mystic to read it. But if the book is done well, it is a mystical journey. And someone is able to walk through in consciousness all of these various components of the patriarchy and go on the same journey to whatever degree they're willing. So I think it's very good news what's happening in the world. It just depends upon your vantage point.
Mm. Well, I thank you so much for being with us today. Let's give out your website. I know you have a website, so let's give that out.
It's unplugged from thepatriarchy.com, and we're actually, in honor of our book launch, running a special price on our website for the book. So a lot of people have been taking advantage of that, and I'm trying to keep it low so this information can get out.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being with us today, Lucia.
My pleasure.
And my guest, Lucia Renee, her book again, Unplugging the Patriarchy, A Mystical Journey into the Heart of a New Age. And I know this is the first of two other books that are joining it. It's going to be a trilogy. Again, Unplugging the Patriarchy, A Mystical Journey into the Heart of a New Age by Lucia Renee. Please stay with us when we come back. We're joined by Lisa Shannon, who is doing some really extraordinary work. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, we're joined by two Harvard neuroscientists to find out what's really going on in the brain of a winner. We'll find out how we can train our brain to perform at a higher level, giving us more focus and emotional balance. We'll also examine what you need to know about a growing concern in America, kids who get caught in the maelstrom of psychiatry and prescription drugs. That's coming next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Lisa Shannon. She is the founder of Run for Congo Women. That began with a lone 30-mile trail run and blossomed into a global volunteer-driven grassroots effort to raise funds and awareness for the women in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we'll find out a little bit more about that in just a moment. Lisa previously owned a photography production company where she served as art director and producer, and lives in Portland, Oregon. Lisa Shannon, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you because I truly mean it very sincerely when I say that you are doing amazing work. This all began, I mean, you were very successful by anybody's standards. You had your own business, you had your own home with its little flower garden, you had a good life. You were watching Oprah one day, and what happened?
Well, I learned for the first time about the conflict in the Congo, which up until that point, I had no idea there was even a war happening there. But, you know, I found out that 1,500 people are dying every day in that conflict, 45,000 people a month. Now the death toll is over 5.4 million, and almost half of those deaths are children under the age of five. But for women, it's widely termed the worst place on earth to be a woman. So rape is widespread, gang rape, sexual torture, sexual slavery, and actually a systematic attempt to destroy women's ability to reproduce. So I just felt really moved, and I instantly signed up to sponsor two women through Women for Women International. That's a program where you can exchange letters with a woman and send her funds, and she's educated in a way that allows her to rebuild her life. But it stayed on my mind, and it was from there that I decided to create The Run.
Yeah, amazing. Now, I read that 6 out of 10 children actually die before the age of 5 in the Congo.
Yeah, I mean, the death toll is extraordinarily high. When I went, when I met with hundreds of women there, it was very rare that I met a woman who had not had a child die. Mm. So that's one thing that, you know, I mean, when you talk with women, of course, sexual violence is a huge issue there, but for the women in Congo, the number one issue on their minds is their children.
Yeah.
So that's a major component.
Yeah, they're just like mothers everywhere. They want their kids to be raised safely and healthily. And I should say that you have written a book about this. You just got back from the Congo, I understand. You've written a book called 1,000 Sisters, My Journey into the Worst Place on Earth to Be a Woman. Let's look at why it is. I've heard several people call it the worst place in the world to be a woman, and it's because of those sexual mutilations. It's because of the rape. It's because very few of them ever see their children grow up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the sexual violence is off the charts. There's I don't think there's anywhere else on the planet where it exists on this scale. I visited communities where 90% of the women had been raped. And when you look at it, I mean, one of the interesting things about what's happening in Congo is considered one of the wealthiest countries on the planet in terms of resources. They have all kinds of minerals, everything you can imagine, from gold to coltan that's used in our cell phones. So a lot of this is, you know, very much about controlling resources. So the kind of terror that takes place there is very much about controlling populations, and I think women are targeted because it's understood that when you attack women, you're destroying not only that individual, but the social structure of the country as well.
Mm-hmm.
So women absolutely are getting the worst of it.
Now, I did read that, I did a little bit of research on coltan, on the minerals that this war apparently is over. They say there's a whole bunch of reasons why they're having this war, but it's been going on a long, long time, I think 10 years, is that right?
Since the Rwandan genocide. It was actually sparked when the Hutu militia responsible for that, for the Rwandan genocide, was pushed over the border into Congo and set up shop. And then other militias were formed to fight them and then each other, and it erupted. I mean, there have been a series of peace accords. So depending on who you talk to, some people will say, well, it's not really an active war, but try telling that to Congolese women. I mean, it's the Hutu militia is still there, terrorizing people. The Congolese army itself is responsible for a huge percentage of the abuses against women.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you've actually been down and you've explored these mines where they're mining for the minerals that actually end up in cell phones, in many cell phones. What kind of things did you see in the mines?
Well, right. So, I did visit several mines actually on this trip, and I mean, the first thing that happened when we showed up is, even though we had all the permissions from the government to visit, we were told even if we had a signed paper from the president of Congo, we would not be allowed in. So there's no rule of law when it comes to mines. I visited a gold mine and ran into a former militia there at the mine. It's what happens is armed groups will go and collect taxes and are able to support themselves by essentially forcing local people to mine for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the goods are smuggled out of the country. So when you look at the money trail, so to speak, countries like Uganda and Rwanda have made an enormous amount of money off of this conflict, and everyone seems to have a vested interest in maintaining the chaos. There's no problem with Congo using its resources in the long run for its own development or for the good of its people, but in this case, what we see is a lot of corporations profiting off of the chaos.
Mm. We talked about how many children are dying, and many of them dying of starvation. Others are actually being recruited at very young ages. In fact, I saw a friend of mine is a filmmaker, and he was out there a few years ago now. But I actually saw raw footage of his work where a young boy was told to kill his mother with one of those huge swords. I can't remember what they're called. His mother had been brutally, brutally raped and beaten. And then he was told by the soldiers to actually kill his mother, which I actually stopped watching. It was really terrible to watch.
Right.
But this kind of thing is happening all the time. You actually went to a hospital, a rehabilitation hospital for child soldiers. What did you see there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I spoke with a number of boys who very much wanted to be able to return to their life, and boys from a number of different militias as well. And for sure, those were the sort of stories that they told. A lot of them had been abducted when they were 12 years old and, had spent the last, 5 years. This time I actually met someone who was 1 year old when the FDLR started doing the attacks in Congo after the Rwandan genocide, and he just now escaped. At 16 years old. So what do we do? What do we do with young men like that who have been raised in that kind of environment? But I think it's a critical piece when we talk about building stability in Congo. You have to have a comprehensive program for disarming, demobilizing, and reintegrating those soldiers. So I think people are doing really heroic work on that front.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of them don't want to be members of a militia. We're talking about a very, very small percentage of men at the top who are controlling these militias. And with the FDLR, for instance, it's estimated that 80% of them would leave if they had the opportunity. And that's where pressure from our government could actually play a really major role.
Yeah. Now, I know that you wrote your book, A Thousand Sisters, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But I know much of the book was actually taken from transcripts from video footage that you took. What was it like for you as a woman being there? I know that on your truck you had a no smoking sign, but it had a no gun sign, meaning you were humanitarian and to be left alone. Were you actually left alone? Were you ever in fear for your life?
Right, the no militias on board.
That's
no, it. No militias may hitchhike sign. Yeah, I did. The thing I always say about safety in Congo is that it's perfectly safe as long as everything goes according to plan. But when things diverge from the plan, then you're in trouble. And there were a couple of times that situations became far more risky than what I had bargained for. There was, I mentioned a village I visited where 90% of the women had been raped.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in that village, it was on a peninsula. It was a two-hour boat ride from the town where we were staying, and I ended up running into a militia there. They saw me with the camera, and we tried to leave as quickly as possible, but ended up caught in the middle of a thunderstorm and actually had to turn back and go back and spend the night in the village with the militia present. And they, in fact, had known that we were present the whole time. So I was very lucky. I mean, white people, Americans are not necessarily targeted in Congo the way they would be in Iraq or Afghanistan. And yet at the same time, it's foolish to think of oneself as immune there. So you do the best you can to be safe, but you know, it's a risky endeavor, you know, especially for me because I wasn't affiliated when I went. I mean, most people, one of the first questions they ask you, anyone you talk to in Congo, is who are you with? And of course, the issue for me is that I wasn't officially with anyone. So, you know, how do you navigate that without security structures? I was very much traveling independently there. So,
well, I want to know, that leads to a question that I want to ask. It's a great segue because I wanted to ask you, what in you, because you were leading what we'd think of as a fairly typical life, you know, you had your own business, your photography studio, as I said, you're engaged to a wonderful man you work with, you have this, you know, seemingly normal, idyllic life. What was it in you that drove you? Because many people sit and watch Oprah or National Geographic or Frontline and don't act on it.
Well, for me, I have to say, you know, I saw the episode of Oprah and was horrified, and then I did some research online, and it was actually on my 30th birthday that I read some firsthand accounts of stories. And there was one woman in particular who told a story about being abducted by a militia, and they were attacking her, about to rape or kill her, and she was begging for her life. And she was told, basically, even if we killed you, what would it matter? Because you're not human. You're like an animal. Mm. Even if we killed you, you wouldn't be missed. And what struck me about that is that in many ways the world has echoed that. That you know, when millions of people have died, and yet it's not even talked about here. And so for me, I had always considered myself the kind of person, when I read about the Holocaust, when I heard about what happened in Rwanda, I thought, surely if I knew something like that was happening, I would be someone who would do something. But I knew after I read those stories that if I did nothing, I would become one person, and if I did something, I'd become someone else. So then it just became a question of finding some simple thing I could do to send the opposite message to women in Congo, that they mattered at least to me, and that I miss the people who have died there, even if I don't know how to stop, you know, what's happening.
You're sending chills down me. I think you're amazing, and I think you're doing amazing work. I know that you are, you called your book A Thousand Sisters.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because ultimately, despite stops and starts at the beginning and sort of stumbling my way through this journey, kind of not knowing how to fundraise or do any sort of public speaking or anything like this, ultimately we have raised more than 1,000 sponsorships for women in Congo. Those women are raising more than 1,000, or more than 5,000 children, rather. We've raised over $650,000 and had more than 4,000 people participate in Run for Congo Women events around the world. So, but for me, it's about even more than that. I mean, in some traditions, you would say the number 1,000 represents infinity. Mm-hmm. And to me, it kind of feels like that. Like it's not just felt about you know, doing a little fundraising run here or there. It's really about building a community of women really working towards building an international women's movement.
Yeah. And I mean, this all started with you just picking up the phone and sponsoring two women yourself.
Right.
I know that you are coming to Seattle. You're going to be talking at the World Affairs Council about this situation. What do you hope will come from your discussion there?
Well, as always, what's important for me is that people feel encouraged to find some simple thing that they can do to plug in. I mean, certainly for me with the book, as I said, I've stumbled my way through this journey. And I think sometimes people feel intimidated to get involved, either because they feel overwhelmed or because they're afraid of doing it wrong. And I hope by me sharing my story about all of the story, including the ways that I've made mistakes along the way, will make it approachable for people, and that they'll feel like, well, if I can just find a few simple things I can do, you know, sponsor a woman in Congo, or join, you know, through Women for Women International, or join the Raise Hope for Congo campaign through the Enough Project to help influence U.S. policy. I mean, they're basic things that people can do. So I really want to encourage everyone to just find some simple thing that they can do to send that message to Congolese women that they matter, and trust that there will be reverberations beyond that that can't be measured. You know, it's like I can list the number of women that we've sponsored, but what was most striking to me in Congo is that in every women's group we talk to, what I heard over and over and over again is, I feel like a human being again. And these are women who had written before, you know, they kill us like animals.
Right.
So there's something very subtle and maybe not measurable, but so powerful that happens when we can step around, you know, the government structures and all of that, and just reach out to another human being and let them know that they matter to us. And I found it's, you know, it ends up being much bigger than you think. Like, I remember the first time we did the New York run, I got a call from the Park Service the night before and asked if we were going to cancel because there was a forecast for gale force winds and this huge storm. And I thought, well, no, we're not going to cancel. Of course we'll show up. And out of, you know, maybe 40 registrants, we had one person show up. And yet that day it was like, do we cancel? Do we walk away just because it's raining and it's bad weather? No.
Right.
We're going to do this. Right. And in the end, you know, it meant something, even though at the time it just felt like hope that it might mean something that we would run in the rain by ourselves.
Oh, you know, and sometimes that's all people need is hope. It's,
yeah.
And you say in the book, one of the women was talking and she said, it's just knowing that somebody knows we're here and not forgotten. We're almost at the end of our segment, Lisa. It's been a pleasure and an honor talking with you. I want to just give out your website, 1000sisters.com. Now, is that the same website that goes, it's not the same website that goes to Run for Congo, is it?
Well, at 1000sisters.com, there's a page that says ACT, and there's a list of about 10 very simple things that people can do to get involved that take about a minute or 2 minutes. So if people are looking for a way to plug in, visit 1000sisters.com and visit the ACT page, and just put in 5 minutes. That's all it really takes.
Mm, doing amazing work. And you are coming to Seattle when?
On Monday, on April 12th.
Okay, at the World Affairs Council.
Yes.
Even if people are interested, they can go along there and see you. And I'm assuming they have other speakers there too, but...
It'll be just me that evening.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, very good. Yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And again, my guest, Lisa Shannon, her book, 1000 Sisters, My Journey into the Worst Place on Earth to Be a Woman, and the website, 1000sisters.com. And please stay with us when we come back. We're talking with one of my favorite storytellers, Diane Hammond. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
You're never too old to fulfill your dream, but sometimes we get caught up making a living instead of creating a life. If you put your dream on hold or can't figure out what to do when you grow up, tell us what's getting in your way. I'm Vicki St. Clair, and I'm excited to let you know that we've partnered with dream coach Joyce Chapman to get your questions answered on air. So tell us what's holding you back. Email your questions and challenges to info@conversationslive.net or leave a confidential voicemail at 425-269-4772. And tune into our third Monday Dream Coach series at noon Pacific on KKNW. See more information at conversationslive.net.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my next guest is fiction writer Diane Hammond. Her new book is called Seeing Stars, which was chosen by over 1,000 independent bookstores across America as the 2010 Indie Next Pick. Diane Hammond is the author of the critically acclaimed novels Hannah's Dream, Going to Bend, and Homesick Creek. She's worked both as a writer and editor and is a recipient of an Oregon Arts Commission Literary Fellowship. She served as spokesman for the Free Willy Keiko Foundation at the Oregon Coast Aquarium and currently lives in Bend, Oregon with her husband and daughter. And Diane Hammond, I'm really pleased to welcome you back. We've talked to you before about Hannah's Dream, and now we're going to talk about Seeing Stars.
Oh, I'm delighted to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, I was saying before we came live that I suspect you had quite a bit of fun. The story behind the story probably was as engrossing as the actual book. So tell us a little bit about Seeing Stars, first of all, and how this all came into play.
Yeah, let me give you an idea about the inspiration of it. My daughter, who was from the age of six, very active in local theater programs, primarily here in Bend, decided by the time she was in her late tween years, say 11, 12, that she really wanted to be a professional actor. And so, of course, being parents who are very supportive of the arts, we, you know, did everything we could think of to further that goal until at about 12, well, really more like 13, she decided that she wanted neither to sing nor dance, which was a good thing because she really could not sing or dance very well, but that ruled out 90%, 99% of theater, because musical theater really is what is primarily out there. So we were kind of left scratching our heads and thinking, well, if it isn't going to be theater and she wants to act professionally, that puts us in a whole different arena, movies and TV primarily. So fortuitously enough, there was a talent manager who works in L.A., represents youth, and came up to Seattle for a weekend to do an acting for the camera class, intensive weekend thing. Carrie went and had a wonderful time, and the manager told us that not only did she believe Carrie had the talent for it, but that she was already pretty old if she was going to really have a chance in L.A. So we went from, maybe we should at least take a seminar, to, oh, my God, the child is getting old. We must do something now. So, I mean, talk about delusional on our part or overly supportive. I'm not sure even now which one. We ended up 4 weeks later living in L.A. and having Carrie hit the ground running, auditioning for everything. And she had a manager and an agent, and man, we were up to our necks in Hollywood.
And this book is not autobiographical, you say, but you saw a lot while you were down there.
We sure did. And it's the only book that I have written that, while it isn't autobiographical in that neither or none of my family is a character in the book, it really does have an awful lot to do with the things that we saw and experienced. And there's no way I could have ever come up with any of this on my own. My imagination isn't that rich. And in the 2 years that we were there, it was the most amazing experience, and in good ways and in not such good ways. And the soil was rich, as they say, and it definitely begged a book. And so obviously Seeing Stars is what came out of it. And it's a situational book, and it does introduce the reader to the world, the universe of particularly child actors, but really all actors in Hollywood, and what they're up against and what kinds of things they're required to do, and the sort of hopes, dreams, disappointments that you deal with on a daily basis.
Mm. Now, I don't know you, Diane, but I've met you. You seem extremely down to earth to me, and so does your husband.
Mm-hmm.
Last person I would think of as a Hollywood mum, you know, as a child star mum. But I'm guessing you ran into some of that down there.
You have to. I mean, yes, you run into it, but you also find yourself doing things that you never would have dreamed of, putting your child in situations that ordinarily you would never do. For instance, Carrie auditioned for an independent film with an extremely good director, and it was a great opportunity, but the character that she was going to be auditioning for smoked and was a kind of juvenile delinquent type.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Carrie was very enthusiastic about the role, and it would have been a great project to do, but it meant that I had to teach my child to smoke, and so I am going to hell. I mean, it was...
Right.
And you know, I did teach her well enough without inhaling to at least be pretty good at faking being a smoker, but sitting here in Bend or in Tacoma, where we lived right before we went to L.A., if somebody had said to me, you are going to teach your child to smoke, I would have said, there is no way. Absolutely not. And so... Your perspective and the things that become important, or at least seem very important at the time, are quite different than what might otherwise strike you had you lived anywhere else.
Yeah. You say that Carrie underwent 2 years of auditions.
Correct.
A ton of work that goes into and around those auditions.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to just 15 days during which she was on set of one production or another.
Mm-hmm.
But that was considered successful, 15 days out of 2 years.
Absolutely. She ended up, you know, with roles on a couple of different sitcoms. One was a primetime sitcom, and she ended up doing that independent film that she learned to smoke for, and she was, by most definitions, quite successful. But if you look at the amount of work and expense and the amount of psychic energy that's required to audition for, oh, it could be two or three things a week, sometimes more, and end up actually booking or landing, say, one of those every 2 or 3 months, you would be very fortunate. And I think that I included, lots of people think that when you get to Hollywood, you're fast-tracked and things are going to go very quickly for you if you're any good. And it's not like that at all. You don't have any way of knowing the competition you're up against and the amount of experience that kids have by the time Carrie was 13 when we arrived.
Mm.
And it was true that she was old, because there have been kids doing this since they were infants or since they were 3 or 4.
Mm.
In fact, I have a character in Seeing Stars who says jokingly that being in the business is what L.A. kids do instead of 4-H. It's just something that's kind of in the blood, and that's what you do.
I had to look up 4-H because I didn't know what it was.
Agricultural things, usually. It's learning to be a good animal husbandry sort of person and, you know, taking really good care of your sheep.
Now, you said you talk about talent versus drive, and
mm-hmm.
You saw a lot of kids with no talent but a ton of drive, others with no drive but good talent. And you said all along to your daughter, this is your dream. If you decide at some point you want to give up, then let us know, because we're doing this for you, not us.
Absolutely.
And then at some point you come back to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it just seemed like natural progression to write about your experiences then.
I suppose so, though. Again, I don't think of myself as writing my experiences,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, most of my books have been things that I've been around, but not necessarily personally experienced in the same way. But the thing that I really had to work through, I think, and probably did in writing Seeing Stars, is exactly that whole talent versus drive dilemma that's true for any of the arts, not just for acting, where there are overwhelmingly more people who either have the talent but not the drive, or the drive not the talent, and in either case lies tragedy. What we were watching while we were down there were children who were phenomenally talented, but really didn't care. I would put my daughter in that category by the end of those 2 years. She had the talent, but she simply didn't have the drive to go through all of the things you need to do in order to hopefully be successful. Worse than that, though, were the children who had a tremendous amount of drive, but no talent.
Mm.
And it's heartbreaking. It is absolutely heartbreaking because they don't see it. And their parents, in most cases, or many cases, don't see it either. And so in a small example, you see what happens in the arts every day. You know, if you want to be a banker, you can probably be a banker. You could even be a mediocre banker and still have a career. That's not true in the arts.
That's true. Well, it's true for you as a writer, too. I mean, it's...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I fought those demons myself for years and years and years and years. And it is truly at the heart of awful things, or can be. And the worst of all, I think, is when the children don't have the drive or don't have the talent, but their parents won't see it.
Mm.
And that's what I think was the alarming side of watching children in L.A.
Yeah.
With so many of them simply didn't have what it would take, but their parents were so desperate for them to be on the cover of People magazine, you know, be at these restaurants that stars frequent, that they just don't see anymore their children for what they are.
Yeah. Well, the book starts, it opens with Ruth Rabinowitz and her 13-year-old daughter abruptly moving from Seattle to L.A. That's kind of what happened with Hilary Swank, I read.
Yes.
Oscar winner.
And she and her mom lived in a car. Hers is one of the stories that everybody knows down there.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, she was extremely successful. And so, you know, there are these tales of triumph that everybody knows and recites to themselves, like George Clooney, you know, had to take 20 different roles to the network before he even landed ER. I mean, there are these apocryphal stories, or some are actually true, that all the kids look to as support, hopefully, for the fact that they will prevail too, though it may take a long time.
Mm. There's a great outtake here from the book. It says, why would they do something like that, especially to children? And the character V said, that's your first mistake. They're not children, they're job applicants. You're new here, aren't you? And then she replies, it shows that much. And V reached over and patted Ruth's hand. Yeah, but enjoy that naivete, honey, because when it wears off, you're going to want to start drinking.
One of my very favorite conversations with V Velman is the cynic in the group, and she's right, you know, she's the hard-boiled one. She's the one who really sees the Hollywood game for exactly what it is. And poor Ruth is, as I was, really a deer in the headlights, trying to be very, very earnest and pick up every perspective and every obligation she can very quickly so as not to hold her daughter back. And she keeps running up against people who are, you know, have a much better sense of what needs to happen than Ruth does. And in every case, Ruth finds those, almost every case, to be somewhat alarming, if not downright scary.
Yeah.
And very expensive, all of it.
I told you before we came live, when I lived down there, we used to call it Holly Weird. I think most people mm-hmm. call it Holly Weird when they live down there. And it is one of those places, love it or hate it. It's mm-hmm. a very definite place. What do you hope people will take away from your new book?
Well, you know, I hope that they get a sense of what it really might feel like to go through that with a child. Because it really is different than if you were a young adult actor and trying to break in. I hope, frankly, that some of it strikes them as funny. I've found that there were things about Hollywood that were very funny and tried to incorporate those as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't deadly serious every minute, and it shouldn't be. But I hope they take away, too, what it requires of parents to parent talented or special children, because it really is different. And if you take a child to Hollywood, you will find that your relationship in some cases flip-flops. It's the child who determines your future, not the other way around.
Yeah.
So there are things about parenting, particularly, that are just way different than any other example I can think of. And if anybody right. reading that book is thinking of taking a child down there, hopefully they'll get that from the book and at least have a better sense of what to expect.
I hope so, too. Diane Hammond, thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Seeing Stars, and I know that, Diane, you are coming up to Bellingham Village Books on Wednesday, April 7th at 7 p.m. We're almost at the end of our show. And then Thursday, April 8th, you'll be at Lake Forest Park, Third Place Books in Bothell. So listeners can find you there. Thank you so much for being with us, Diane.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And my guest, Diane Hammond, her book, Seeing Stars. And thank you for being with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we're joined by two Harvard neuroscientists to find out what's really going on in the brain of a winner. We'll find out how we can train our brain to perform at a higher level, giving us more focus and emotional balance. We'll also examine what you need to know about a growing concern in America, kids who get caught in the maelstrom of psychiatry and prescription drugs. That's coming next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.